CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show,
Pamina Abkowitz will be telling us a little bit about Acres.
So what can you tell me about Acres?
Well, so Acres is, as the acronym would indicate, it's the American Council on Rural Special Education. It was founded in 1981, and it has grown since then. At our last national conference, which was held about 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas, Nevada, had over 200 participants, including local teachers, parents, service providers, researchers, teacher preparation program, professors. And so really what we're all about is looking at the really unique challenges of individuals with exceptionalities that are in rural settings. And so we're a unique organization in that our focus is on rural special education. And so because there's so much variety all across the country and even in, you know, Canada, in South America, Central America, we have people that have participated from New Zealand, and Australia. So, you know, we try to talk about a lot of the unique differences with different rural areas and try to bring best practices to light and try to provide supports for special educators and service providers in rural settings, because a lot of times they're the only ones that are there and it can be a pretty lonely place to be.
So, in that sense, what are some of the key areas that need addressing as far as special education in rural areas? What are some of the challenges that might be faced?
So I think one of the big challenges from our perspective is in really providing connections for people that are in rural areas between parents and students, individuals with disabilities, and service providers, and being able to get access to support. I think that while school districts are really making a lot of effort in that direction, we are also looking at ways that we can help provide support so that parents and individuals with disabilities that are over the age of 21, students that are under the age of 21 that are transition planning, you know, making sure that we're, first of all, that we're teaching our future teachers best practices in providing supports for students with special needs, as well as any other student that's in their classroom. But then also thinking about what the needs of different rural areas are, and in trying to connect people in those rural areas with either experts in the field that may know or have done research on a particular topic. Like, for example, if a school district was interested in implementing, you know, transition planning and wanted to have transition fairs and college fairs, but because it's a small rural district, they can't afford by themselves necessarily to pay for somebody to come in and speak. And so we may help them connect with other districts nearby and then be able to provide transition services and supports to everybody that's in multiple districts, but they join together And a lot of times we can serve as that conduit because they just don't realize that they can do that, and that it's a way to make sure that everybody's pooling together and providing those supports, particularly students with extensive needs, because there may only be one or two in a given district. And it's very hard to, if you can get other students that also have more extensive needs, then you can have a teacher that can be in a district that's nearby, as opposed to having to bus a student an hour or two away to get supports and services.
I'm curious.
So we see that. We had a lot of conversation also at our last conference around AI and ChatGPT. And the use of that in the classroom, and how to teach future teachers how to utilize it, rather than seeing it as something that's, oh, well, you know, you can't do that because it's artificial and it's not true. Except that a lot of times it can provide really nice information. So, for example, if you're teaching a child who's needs ABA, you know, step-by-step support, you can actually put into ChatGPT whatever chain you need to put in, so tying your shoelaces, and it will give you how to break that down step by step to teach the child how to tie their shoes. And so it's really neat. I had my students in my behavior management class yesterday looking at different strategies that they would be needing to use for a case study that they're writing a functional behavioral assessment and behavior support plan. And be able to look at, okay, so how do I break these things down into manageable pieces, and then teach that also to their classroom teacher that sees them for part of the day, so that they can also provide that consistency and support.
So in your time with ACRES, has there been any success moment that stands out for you? We were able to provide especially meaningful direction to those working in special education.
Yeah, I think that when this last session, we had a teacher event. So one of the things that we try to do when we have our national conferences is we provide free professional development to local teachers and local school districts that are within the area, the state. We offer support for teachers to be able to attend the conference at a reduced price, if not completely free. And so one of the things that I think that we felt really good about is increasing that partnership, and then increasing our membership by reaching out to practitioners, to other researchers in the field, to people involved in state and federal government, and really making those connections, because we're all trying to row the boat in the same direction. We all want to provide supports and services for individuals with exceptionalities in all areas, but particularly rural areas, because it is so difficult, again, to feel like you're part of a community. And I think giving people a sense of that, and I had several teachers who were teachers in the field who came up to me and said, this was so fantastic, and I want to come back next year because I learned so much, and I'm going to take these things back with me to my classroom and show my, you know, my gen ed colleagues this material so that they can start to implement it in their classroom. And that's what we want. We want people that are working with individuals with disabilities to have this information and to be able to use it to support people and have them, you know, be successful, independent, you know, participants in American society or wherever society they're in, whatever country they're in. So I think that was a really cool aha moment for me.
If you could send any message to the community about the need for equal inclusion in rural areas in special education, what would you say?
That's a really good question. I think, to me, it's all about relationships. And I tell this to my students all the time that, you know, and it's one of the things that we're focusing on as an ACRES board for this upcoming year is making connections and relationships with individuals who have exceptionalities, with individuals who work with people with exceptionalities, to open the lines of communication and to start to think about ways that we can work with each other and help each other. You know, we're looking for partnerships and research so that we're actually teaching people best practices and having them implement them in their classrooms or in a real world setting. And so I think I would invite any of your listeners to please contact the American Council on Rural Special Education and sign up to come to our conference. We would love to have you, and we would love to be able to work with you and to help provide support for you. And to help, because ultimately we all want the same thing, which is for individuals with disabilities to actually be included, as opposed to just having a seat in the room. You know, you need to provide the right kinds of supports, and having individuals with disabilities actually tell us what it is that they need and to be able to advocate for themselves. They're not broken. They just may learn differently. And so the more that individuals can share with us what their needs are, the more that we can then begin to partner with them, with families, with schools, agencies, and really start to really level the playing field. But we need them to come and be at the table with us.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Sonia White Crosadile will be telling us a little bit about SJS Canada. So what can you tell me about SJS Canada?
We are a registered nonprofit organization. We are located in Canada, but we operate in the virtual world, serving individuals who survived the illness, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and toxic epidermal necrolysis. So we serve that community, including their peer supporters, friends, and also the medical community. We offer support, education, awareness, and through our support group and various educational sessions.
So how does the syndrome typically affect a person?
The syndrome basically starts off with flu-like symptoms, and then it rapidly spirals into blisters and red eyes and generalized weakness and pain. Normally, it is confused with a variety of different illness, but in the long run, what it literally does is burn your body from the inside out, affecting every organs in the body. And if it's not promptly diagnosed and treated, it can result in death, because 25% of individuals die as a result of lack of diagnosis and treatment.
Do you know offhand about how many people are affected by the syndrome?
By this syndrome, it affects up to 7 persons per million globally. So it may seem rare, because the individuals that it's affect is all over the world. But when you start get into a community such as SJS Canada, you realize it is not so rare after all, because right here within Canada, there are over 20 plus individuals who have suffered from this illness and counting.
So how does SJS Canada reach out to those who could benefit from the supports you offer?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
So, how do you folks reach out to the affected community?
We are working closely with some hospitals, like Sunnybrook Hospital, their burn unit. We have their dermatology unit, BC Children's Hospital, and we're also working with Alberta Health Science Services. They do have a burn unit there. And so we basically try to reach out to dermatologists, family physicians, and just broadcast on the internet to let people know that this illness exists and we exist to provide support along the road of recovery, because it's a lonely road and there are not many resources out there at all.
So in your time with SJS Canada, has there been any success you've seen for the organization?
There has been milestones of success with the organization. We have been, we have gained recognition and visibility within the virtual world and among some top hospitals, and also in reaching individuals, because we are currently supporting individuals on pretty much every continent in the world. And it may sound strange, but yes, we do get individuals who connect with us from all over the world. And that's because they are searching for information, searching for support that has not been available. And because our organization, they're able to get like one-on-one support, be it through email or Zoom, Zoom conversations, so they're able to speak to specialists in the SJSTEN field, get their question answered, and get the supports that they need.
If you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in awareness and advocacy, what would you say?
I would say to them, Stevens-Johnson syndrome is a real illness. It leads to death, and so you need to be aware of the symptoms and find immediate help. If you experience any of the symptoms, the classical symptoms, go to an emergency room, because you never know that it may end up being Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Save your life, and also for the community to know that they should educate themselves before they medicate, because this is an illness that mainly results from allergic reaction to certain medications. And so if you are aware of the syndrome, then it can create a red flag when you're reading your medication labels. You will watch out for the warning signs. Because 11 years ago, I had the syndrome. I almost died. The doctors and the hospital that treated me knew nothing about the illness. That's another story. But anyhow, my life inspired. But when I left hospital and was seeking support, because everything about my life changed, my life totally fell apart, and there was no resources. And so in collaboration with a dermatologist at Sunnybrook, I decided, along with my family and friends, to form this organization to provide support to individuals along the way, because there's so many unknown, and the recovery process is horrendous. And as I mentioned, it touches every system of your body, and that is where the challenges happen, because so many things change afterwards that you don't even realize it's connected to. And many community physicians are not aware, and so we provide this help where individuals can be supported.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
And then I noticed this old guy, face like an old shoe, and he walked across the room. And there in the corner, I hadn't seen it before, was this jukebox, and he put in a coin. and he pressed three buttons. And then...
Cowboys and Indies has been bringing you the best in British indie and alternative music for over 30 years on CJAM. Tune in every Saturday night from 9 p.m. until midnight as we bring you the best in British indie and alternative music right here on CJAM 99.1 FM, CJAM.ca, and Kochiko 285. We are redefining radio in Windsor and Detroit.
You see, the thing that makes sense of this crazy world is rock and roll.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Amina Abkowitz told us a little bit about Acres, and Sonia White Crossadile told us a little bit about SJS. In this segment of our show, Dr. Andrew Burkowski will be telling us about the RLS Foundation. So what can you tell me about the RLS Foundation?
Restless Leg Syndrome Foundation is based in the U.S., and its primary goal is to advocate for patients with the condition restless leg syndrome, and also an educational and research role, including the funding of grants for research and establishing things like a clinical consensus guidelines or different types of expert opinion papers regarding the treatment of restless leg syndrome. They also advocate at a national level in the United States in terms of trying to bring funding toward research for neurologic conditions and sleep conditions as well.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, what are some of the common impacts of RLS?
Well, restless leg syndrome, it's described as exactly as it sounds, but it's sort of the idea of the devastating impact of it potentially. It's not just a nuisance or an annoying symptom. It actually can disrupt sleep to such an extent that people can get very little sleep and become very sleep deprived. It can have a lot of distressing effects, like any type of chronic pain condition, where people are in a state of distress or they can't sit down for long periods of time, they can't travel, and then it can have an emotional impact, which is secondary to that, where it creates a lot of anxiety and feeling unwell about one's own health and well-being. So it can be a very disruptive condition, even though it may not be specifically life-threatening.
So, in that sense, when you mentioned advocacy, I'd imagine some of the issues facing those with restless leg syndrome concern things like employment and things of that nature, in so much as if you don't get the proper sleep, chances are you're not going to be as effective in a workplace.
Yes, there are a lot of people. They may even be retiring early or on a disability because of the effects of this. It's not just the sleep. The sleep disruption can impair work function and that through the sleep channel. But it's also the restless legs itself, where if people are, for example, they're at a desk all day or a job where they don't have the flexibility to move around or walk around much, the symptoms can be actually very, very difficult to tolerate. So they can't even perform their work because it's just so uncomfortable, just as if the work itself were causing pain.
So, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning the condition?
Well, for maybe 20 to 25 years ago, many in the medical field were not certain that it was a real condition. They thought it may be just a psychological condition, or people who are just restless, their mind was restless. And with the overwhelming scientific research that's occurred in the past quarter century, a lot is known about the neurologic mechanisms that cause the condition. It's a brain condition. And so the myth that it's all in somebody's head, it's sort of true. It's all in the head. It's actually a brain condition, but it's not a psychological condition. It certainly can be affected by a psychological state of mind, and the condition itself can have a psychological impact, but it's a physical brain disorder, and we know a lot about it now. And so that's been the biggest myth, is getting the medical community to take the condition seriously, which they're starting to do now, and then recognizing that this is a condition that needs to be treated in a lot of cases, and people really struggle with it, and it is worth addressing from a medical perspective.
So, in your time with the foundation, Has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, a big one, which is an ongoing one, is the movement of the treatment for restless leg syndrome. It's actually changed almost 180 degrees in the past 10 to 15 years. The Restless Leg Syndrome Foundation has been at the forefront of providing the research and the education. These medications called dopamine agonists have been the first-line medications since the early 2000s. And since about 2016, they've no longer been considered first-line because they actually make the condition worse over time. So the majority of individuals who are treated for the condition are under the wrong treatment currently. And this is worldwide, not just in the United States or Canada, but worldwide, the majority of individuals are treated with dopamine agonists, and they really should not be used for the most part because they do worsen the condition. So the RLS Foundation has been at the forefront of this. They had a consensus paper published in 2021 that helped to spread the alarm of this, and they continue to provide both webinars, patient advocacy to bring up the point that this treatment change is underway, and it's going to take a long time to get the medical field to change to follow the experts' knowledge, but they've been at the forefront of providing that kind of education.
So, do you have any advice for someone out there who might be starting this journey, just realizing this could be what's affecting them? Any steps they can take to sort of prepare themselves for what's ahead and get educated on the subject?
Yeah, so the first thing is to make sure that the diagnosis is correct. Unfortunately, there's no objective test for restless leg syndrome, and so making sure that the clinician has properly evaluated them and that they have the right diagnosis, it's not a condition that mimics restless leg syndrome. And then the second thing is to be evaluated for iron levels. One of the big research changes has been over the last 10 or 15 years, the critical nature of iron, that this condition is caused by low iron levels in certain areas of the brain. So getting blood testing for iron should be done by every person with significant restless leg symptoms, and that should be done at least on an annual basis. And the clinicians should know the levels at which people need to have sufficient iron levels, and those can be supplemented through diet, through iron supplements, or through an intravenous iron infusion where iron is given directly into the bloodstream. That should be done before anybody ever discusses a medication or any other treatment. And that's really, those are probably the two main first steps that people need to know. Get the diagnosis correct, get iron levels tested.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
All right, sure.
Rural special education, my friends, is vital to the community. For the fact of the matter is, no matter where a person with a disability lives or under what circumstances, they're just as entitled to equal education and equal access in society. And during the pandemic, this might have proved especially difficult for those living in remote areas. Getting through, getting education without necessarily the correct technological access. However, I heard many stories of people coming together just trying to go the extra mile for persons with disabilities. Fact is, it is their right to learn and grow alongside anyone else in society. Whether you're in a rural community or an urban area bustling with activity, your disability is no more or less valid than anyone else's, and you are entitled to the same decency, same considerations, same humanity as anyone else. And honestly, I'm so pleased to speak to an organization like ACRES, doing work just to provide that equality, that hope, there can be, really, a global disability community. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.